this argument. So I do the only thing I can do. I ignore it and kiss him gently on the cheek. Your car pulls here, Mr. Stark. You don't want to be late for homeroom. I turn to head inside, but he grabs my hand and pulls me back. His kiss is long and deep and makes my knees go weak. But Damien considerately holds me up so that I don't collapse in a puddle on the flagstone tiles. What was that for? I breathe when he releases me.
A reminder that I believe in you, he says.
Oh. His voice is filled with so much pride and confidence that I wish I could soak it up like a drug.
And a promise of things to come, he adds with a sexy curve to his lips. I'll call you when I get back. I'm not sure how late I'll be.
The helicopter's not as speedy as it looks, I tease.
More like my colleagues don't conduct business as expediently as I'd like.
No prob. I should have dinner with Jamie tonight anyway. I've been a best friend in absentia lately. I start to pull away, but his fingers tighten around mine. What?
I don't want to go.
His grin is boyish, and I laugh with delight. Damien is so many things, and I am falling hard for all of them. But if you don't, then how can I spend the day looking forward to having you back?
You're a very wise woman,
he says, then presses a fresh kiss to my lips. Until tonight. Chapter 7. Edward greets me outside by the door of a gracious silver and burgundy car that looks like it belongs on Masterpiece Theater. New car?
No, ma'am, Edward says. Mr. Stark rebuilt her about 3 years ago.
Really? I look the car over, wondering when on earth Damien found the time. I try to imagine him under the chassis, his hands dirty and a spot of grease on his nose. Surprisingly, it's an easier picture to conjure than I would have imagined. As I've seen time and again, Damien can do pretty much anything, and look damn good doing it, too. As for looking damn good, the car certainly fits that bill. It's all soft curves and flowing lines, the epitome of automotive class and grace. It's almost a crime that Edward wears a simple suit instead of livery, and it wouldn't surprise me a bit if his voice took on a British tinge. He is oblivious to the way my mind is wandering.
We normally reserve the Bentley for formal occasions, but Mr. Stark thought you might enjoy arriving at your new position in style.
As he speaks, the helicopter rises from behind the house, far enough away that it barely kicks up a breeze. It's too far for me to see Damien, but I lift my hand anyway and wave a silent thank you. I need to go home, actually, not work, but Mr. Stark was right about the rest, I say as I slide past Edward into the car. I'm definitely going to enjoy this ride.
I'm afraid Mr. Stark was very clear that I am to see you safely to your office.
Was he? I consider pulling out my cell phone and giving Damien a piece of my mind, but that would ultimately change nothing. I consider my options and then nod. Fine, I finally say, pushing my irritation aside. But I do have to go home first.
Of course, Ms. Fairchild.
He shuts the door, and I'm snug in a leather and wood cocoon, breathing in the scent of luxury. The windows, I notice, are not electric, but instead operate with old-fashioned knobs that appear to be mahogany and are polished to a sheen. The white leather seat is as soft as butter, and the seat back in front of me actually has a tray table. I defy convention and release it from its full upright and locked position. It eases down to form a perfectly positioned writing surface. I'm suddenly overcome with a longing for a quill pen and parchment. What year is the car? I ask Edward as he maneuvers us down the drive.
It's a 1960 S2 saloon, he says. Only 388 were produced, and I'm afraid there are very few still on the road. When Mr. Stark ran across this one in a junkyard, he was determined to bring it back to its former glory. I'm not at all certain what Damien would have been doing in a junkyard, but it takes no effort whatsoever to imagine his determination. What Damien wants, Damien gets, be it a classic car, a Santa Barbara hotel, or me. I run my finger over the varnished surface of the desk, the motion reminding me of my earlier whimsy. You don't happen to have a paper and pen up there, do you?
Certainly, Edward says.
He leans over and pulls something out of the glove box, then passes a folio back to me. I open it and find a fountain pen and heavy linen stationery monogrammed with DJS, Damien's initials. I hesitate. I hadn't really expected that Edward would have the things I asked for, and now that I'm faced with the prospect of putting my thoughts on paper, I am suddenly tongue-tied, or finger-tied, as the case may be. But this is too sweet an opportunity to squander, so I draw a breath, put the nib of the pen on the paper, and begin to write. My very dear Mr. Stark, before I met you, I never gave any thought to the sensual nature of an automobile. But now, once again, I am surrounded by soft leather, snug in the warm embrace of this graceful, powerful vehicle. It is heady stuff, and I continue to write, pouring out my teasing phrases through the intimate flow of ink onto paper. As I watch my precise handwriting fill the page, I almost regret the tech revolution. How wonderful to have received a letter from a lover. To open it and see his heart on the page, his handwriting bold and strong. There's an immediacy to texts and emails that can't be denied, but the intimacy of a letter really can't be replicated. By the time Edward pulls up in front of the condo that I share with Jamie in Studio City, I have finished the note. I fold it neatly, slide it into the matching envelope I find in the folio pocket, seal it, and print my return address on the top left corner. I realize then that I don't know the street address of Damien's Malibu house. Odd, considering how much time I've been spending there. But it doesn't matter. The letter will reach him just as easily at his office building, which is also where his downtown apartment is located. I print his name and address neatly across the center of the envelope. Damien Stark, CEO, Stark International, Stark Tower Penthouse, South Grand Avenue, Los Angeles, California, 90071. I can't remember the street number for the tower, but under the circumstances, I imagine that the post office can deal. I find a stamp in my wallet and affix it to the envelope. Then I slip out of the car and smile at Edward. I need to shower and change and grab a few things. I might be a while.
That won't be a problem, he says,
and as I head toward the stairs, he slips back behind the wheel. I feel absolutely no guilt whatsoever about my plan. Edward undoubtedly has an audiobook, and it's not as if he needs to go back to Malibu in order to drive Damien around. By the time he realizes that I have snuck down the back stairs to my own car, I imagine he'll have gotten in quite a bit of quality time with whatever book he's enjoying. I slide the letter through the outgoing mail slot before I hurry up the stairs to the condo, calculating the time I have to shower and change and get to the office. Traffic was worse than Edward had expected. There was a wreck on the 405, and I'm going to be more rushed than I'd intended. I know I could have simply worn one of the zillion outfits that Damien has stocked for me, but this new job is my territory. And silly or not, I want to wear my own clothes and drive my own car. I expect to find the door unlocked, because Jamie never remembers to lock the damn thing. So I'm surprised to find both the deadbolt and the knob locked up tight. I dig my keys out of my purse, then frown as I enter the dark apartment. She's probably asleep, and I hope that she's alone. She probably is. Though Jamie drags men home like stray cats, she routinely kicks them out once they've given her bedsprings a thorough shaking. It's dangerous, and I worry, because it's almost become a game with her. Unlike the games I play with Damien, though, I don't think there's any sort of safe word for Jamie. Her door is closed, and I consider passing by. But this is my first day at work, and I want to see my best friend. I tap lightly on the door, then lean close to listen. I expect either a groan or a startled apology followed by a rush to the door and a hug for me on my first day. But there's only silence. James? I tap harder, but there's still no answer. I take hold of the knob and turn, trying to both look and not look, just in case she finally let the guy she dragged home stay for the entire night. But the room is both dark and empty. I tell myself not to worry. Jamie probably just had somewhere to be this morning. Or else she crashed somewhere after a night of partying. Except I don't really believe either of those explanations. Jamie's not an early riser, and she rarely stays overnight anywhere. She's not the kind to crash on a couch. She likes the comforts of home too much. I hope I'm overreacting, but I pull out my phone and tap out a text. Where are you? Do I need to send out a search party? I wait, staring at the screen, but my phone stays silent. Well, shit. I call, but the phone rolls over to voicemail. Now my stomach really is in knots. I can't call the police. I may not watch much television, but I've watched enough to know that they won't do a thing unless it's been 24 hours. I almost dial Damien, but my finger hesitates over his name. There might be nothing he can do, but if I'm worried, I'm almost positive that he'll cut his meeting short and come to me no matter how much I protest. He may be firmly perched on a white steed in my mind, but I am most definitely not a damsel in distress, and really don't want to be. Fine. Okay. No problem. Jamie's probably just in the shower, which is where I need to be. I'll shower and change, and if she hasn't called me back by the time I'm ready to head downtown, I'll call and text her again. And if she still doesn't answer, I'll call Ollie. I don't know what he could do, but as my other best friend, I'm allowed to call him in a crisis. And with Ollie, my odds of interrupting a billion-dollar summit are significantly lessened. Most important, though, and as much as I hate to admit it, there's a possibility that they're together. They slept together one time that I know of, and though Jamie swears it was a singular event, and though Ollie has assured me that he's been otherwise faithful to his fiancée, I'm not certain that I really believe either one of them. My doubts weigh on me, because Jamie and Ollie are my two best friends, and I don't like the way their tryst has clouded up things among the three of us. I'm frustrated as I head into my own bedroom and toss the phone onto my bed, barely missing Lady Meow Meow, who has blended in so well with my white duvet I don't see her. She lifts her head in sleepy protest, stares at me until I apologize, and then promptly goes back to sleep. Apparently, our cat doesn't share my concern about Jamie's whereabouts. Partly because I'm running late, and partly because I don't want to be away from the phone that long, I rush through my shower. I towel dry my hair until it's damp, then use some gel to twist a few curls into place. I've discovered that it's much easier to take care of shoulder-length hair than the tresses that used to fall midway down my back. Not that I want to repeat my meltdown, but on this small point, I think it worked out okay. I wrap a towel around me, then open the door to our tiny bathroom. A cloud of steam escapes ahead of me, and I follow it out, then jump about a foot when I hear the sharp crash of ceramic shattering against the tiled kitchen floor. For an instant, I'm terrified, imagining intruders and boogeymen and God knows what. But what would have been a scream breaks into a relieved burst of laughter when I hear Jamie's voice cutting sharply through the apartment. Oh, fuck a duck! Nikki, I just killed your favorite coffee mug. I'm right here, I call, hurrying down the two stairs, my back to our tiny dining area, as I face Jamie in the kitchen. She looks at me oddly, probably because I'm still laughing. She holds up the handle of my Dallas Cowboys mug. The rest of the shattered blue ceramic is scattered on the tile at her feet. Sorry, she says. It's okay. I'm still laughing. I don't know why. Relief, I guess. It was a ridiculous favorite anyway, she says, as if I'm giving her grief about the mug. You don't even like football. It was big, I said. It could hold hot chocolate and marshmallows without the chocolate dribbling over the side when you stick a spoon in. Yeah, but what's the point of drinking hot chocolate with marshmallows if you're going to be all prissy about it? I can't argue with that, so I don't. Instead, I shove my feet into a pair of flip-flops that are by the stairs, then step gingerly into the kitchen to get the small broom and dustpan I put under the sink after I moved in. Thanks, she says, then rolls her eyes when I hand the broom to her. Okay, she sighs. Fine. As she squats down, much better dressed for the job in jeans than I am in my towel, I ask where she's been. I was worried, I admit. Did you sleep somewhere else? Shit, no. She brushes the last of the mug splinters into the dustpan, then tilts her head to aim a cat-ate-the-canary grin up at me. I may have stayed out all night, but I didn't sleep. Her dreamy grin fades and she peers hard at me. And you? Because it seems to me your bed's not getting all that much action lately. Pretty soon you're going to have to sign the poor thing up for therapy. Loneliness can lead to depression, you know. I'll get right on that, I say dryly. And as a matter of fact, no, I wasn't here either. Uh-huh. I hold my hands up in surrender. I didn't say a word, I point out. But if I were going to say something, it would only be that when I stay out all night, it's with the same guy. You have so many different men, you should start a Facebook page just to keep track of them. Not a bad plan, actually. Except that I think this guy might be something special. I gape. Seriously? Totally. He's not as fuckalicious as Damien King of the World Stark, but I wouldn't run screaming from a repeat performance. Or even a triple play, for that matter. This is as close as I've ever heard Jamie get to discussing a relationship. To say I'm bowled over would be an understatement. You can't just drop a bomb like that on me when I'm running late. So come on. We can talk while I get dressed. She follows me into my bedroom and perches at my desk in front of my laptop. It's open, and the screensaver is a slideshow of pictures of Damien that I took in Santa Barbara. Damien with so much light and humor in his eyes that I can't ever look at those photos without smiling. Between that screensaver and the exquisite original Monet painting Damien gave me that now hangs between my desk and my dresser, I cannot enter this room without feeling cherished. It's a nice feeling, and one that I am not used to. In college, my apartment was simply a place to live. With my mother, my room was the place I wanted to escape. But here, there is Jamie and my newfound freedom. There is excitement. There is potential. Most of all, there is Damien. This room is proof that I really have moved on, and that where I am going is where I want to be. At my desk, Jamie is typing away. Rain, she finally says. I'm standing by my closet, debating between a blue skirt and a gray one, and it takes me a moment to realize she's not talking about precipitation. Brian Rain, she says when I turn to face her, as if that will make me understand. Since my face apparently continues to register complete cluelessness, she shakes her head in mock exasperation and taps the laptop screen. My guy is Brian Rain. Despite my rush, I'm curious enough to forgo my wardrobe analysis to see what she's doing, and when I reach my desk, I see that she's pulled up a series of images. They're all of the same man. Gorgeous, mostly shirtless, with a well-fucked quality and the kind of eyes and facial structure and that dirty blonde hair a camera loves. Most of the images, in fact, are from advertisements. Cars, men's cologne, jeans. I have to confess that the man could definitely sell a pair of jeans. That's him, Jamie says proudly. That's the guy you were out with last night? Yup, she grins mischievously. Though we stayed in most of the time. Pretty hot, huh? He's incredible, I say, as I move to my dresser and rummage for panties and a bra. For a moment, I hesitate. In the game I've been playing with Damien, I've had to follow his rules. And for the last 2 weeks, I've worn neither bra nor panties. It was odd at first, but undeniably sexy, especially when I was with him, knowing that at any moment he could slip a hand under my skirt, that he could touch me, tease me, even finger fuck me. There's something desperately erotic about being naked beneath your clothes, and even when Damien wasn't around, my body was keyed up, and I was aware of every brush of material over my rear and every whisper of a breeze that stroked my sex. But this isn't a game. It's the first day of a new job, and the Elizabeth Fairchild rules for living are too ingrained in my life. I might have spent my entire life trying to escape from my mother, but she has still soaked in through the cracks. And in my mother's world, the thrill of sexual freedom doesn't override the necessity of panties at work. I slip on my underwear, sigh, and return to the closet to continue debating my outfit. I glance at Jamie to see if she has an opinion, but she's still gazing dreamily at the screen. Don't get drool on my keyboard, I chide. So how did you meet him? He's my co-star, she says, referring to the commercial she's about to start shooting. He mostly models, but he's also done a few television guest appearances, and he was even one of the bad guys in the last James Bond movie. He was? I'd actually seen that movie, and I don't remember him. Well, he stood around with a gun and looked hot, she amends. But he was on the bad guy team. But you guys haven't started to shoot yet? I say, because I'm still confused. So why did you go out with him? Which one? I add, holding up the two skirts I'm considering. The blue. And he called me. He said that since the commercial is basically a love story in 30 seconds, we ought to go out and suss out our chemistry. I take it the chemistry is good? Sizzling, Jamie agrees. And although I'm still not thrilled about the ease with which Jamie bounces from bed to bed, I can't deny that this morning my roommate looks good. Sparkly, fizzy good. And I figure that the new job and the new guy have a lot to do with that. I feel a surge of protectiveness mixed with relief and tinged with a tiny bit of worry. Jamie's never confided in me about it, but I'm pretty sure that before I moved in, she often chose her men based not on attraction, but on their willingness to help her make the mortgage. If a real relationship develops between Jamie and Brian Rain, no one will be happier than me. But if he ends up breaking her heart, I have a feeling that my strong, self-sufficient roommate will shatter. I glance at her and see that she's frowning. I swallow, afraid that my fears show on my face. What is it? You're really wearing a skirt? I thought you tech folks were all about the jeans and t-shirts with math equations. I scowl, because I happen to own several t-shirts with truly funny math jokes. First day on the job, and I'm not doing the tech side, remember? I'm management. I want to look professional. I've zipped up the blue skirt, and now I slide my feet into my favorite pair of pumps, then slip on a white silk shell that I top with a darling jacket I found at one of the studio resale shops that Jamie took me to during our Nikki just arrived in L.A. shopping spree. It has a classical cut, with a muted pattern in gray and blue. The clerk told us that it was worn by one of the characters on some television show I never watched, but that Jamie assured me was great fun. I want to hear more about this guy, I tell her, as I move back into the bathroom to fly through my makeup routine. But I have to get going. She follows me and leans against the door as I finish up by carefully lining my eyes and brushing mascara on my lashes. When I'm done, I do a little spin in the tiny area between the tub and the sink. Do I look okay? When don't you? She asks. And if anyone asks, Lauren Graham wore that jacket on Gilmore Girls. Trust me, it's cool. I nod, taking her word for it. Want to meet after work? I'll tell you about Rain, and you can tell me all about your nights away from home, too. I want to hear everything.
Sounds good, I say, not bothering to tell her that where Damien is concerned, there is no way that I'm going to be revealing everything.
Do pars? I ask. Are you shitting me? I want a drink. Meet me at Firefly, she says, referring to a local bar on Ventura Boulevard that we went to my first night in town.
I'll text you as I'm leaving work, I say, then pull her into a hug. I'm really glad about this guy. I can't wait to hear more.
I can't wait to see more, she says with a wicked grin. Trust me, I could look at that man all day.
I leave Jamie sighing and probably replaying last night's coital gymnastics in her mind, then hurry down the back stairs to the parking area. As I pull out, I see the limo in my rearview mirror. I keep an eye on it until I turn, but it doesn't move from the spot, and as I turn onto Ventura Boulevard, I can't help but smile. After all, it's not every day I manage to outmaneuver Damien Stark. Despite the fact that my ancient Honda has very little spunk and has lately taken to stalling out at stoplights, I managed to get from Studio City to the Innovative Resources office in Burbank in less than 15 minutes, completely stall-free. I consider this a stellar beginning to the day. I park next to a red Mini Cooper that I eye jealously, then lock my car and head toward the ugly four-story stucco building that houses the Innovative offices, along with a few subtenants. My phone beeps, and I pause in the middle of the parking lot to pull it out of my purse, then smile when I see it's from Damien.
Thinking of you. Be good on your first day. Get along with the other kids, but don't share your candy.
I laugh and tap out a reply. I only share my candy with you.
His reply makes me smile.
Very glad to hear it.
I answer quickly. Heading into building now. Wish me luck. His response is just as quick.
Luck, though you don't need it. Meeting reconvening. Must go. Tonight, baby. Until then, imagine me touching you.
I always do, I reply. Then sigh happily as I slide my phone back into my purse, but not before noticing the time. It's only 9:45, which means that I have 15 minutes before I'm supposed to report for work. My phone rings and I pull it out. Damien again. I'm imagining, I say, keeping my tones sultry.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
He doesn't sound sultry at all. In fact, he sounds downright pissed. I grimace. Apparently, he's just spoken to Edward.
Going to work? I say.
I'm supposed to be in a meeting right now.
So why aren't you?
Damn it, Nikki.
No, I snap. I'm the only one who gets to say that. Damn it, Damien, I am perfectly capable of driving myself. And if you want to hire out Edward, then ask me. It's easy. You walk up to me and say, Nikki, darling, light of my life, can I have my driver take you to work? There is a pause, and I hope that he is laughing.
And you would have said yes?
No, I admit. But that's the way you should have handled it. It's my job, Damien. I want to drive myself. I will drive myself.
I don't want you around the paparazzi without someone there with you.
Oh, I feel a little bit better. I don't agree with what he did, but at least there was a reason for doing it. Nobody's here, I say.
But there could have been.
And I would have dealt with it, I say, probably too sharply. I count to five. You can't be with me every second of every day, no matter how much I wish you could. I'm going to see them when I'm alone. It's going to happen, and we both just have to deal with it. I hear him exhale.
I don't like it.
Me neither.
Damn it, Nikki.
I don't answer. I don't know what to say. Finally, Damien speaks.
I'm going to my meeting,
he says, but what he means is, I'm worried about you. I'm fine,
I say. And Damien?
Yes.
Thank you. Write a motion, crappy execution. That gets a laugh out of him.
We'll have to agree to disagree on that, he says. It is not an argument I can have from Palm Springs.
I frown. Apparently, it is an argument he can have in Los Angeles. Great. He really does have to go to his meeting, so he ends the call, and I'm left scowling at my phone and the knowledge that I'm going to have to deal with not only the paparazzi, but with Damien trying to babysit me through my day. I shove the problem out of my head and hurry into the building. I no longer have time to grab a coffee, but that's okay, because I don't want to risk spilling it on my white blouse. As my mother's voice in my head reminds me, there are better ways to make a first impression than coffee stains on your outfit. The reception area is on the fourth floor, and I punch the elevator call button and wait impatiently for the elevator to arrive. The doors finally slide open, and I shift to one side to let the passengers get off. I'm about to step into the car when I hear a throaty, familiar voice behind me.
Well, look at you, Texas, all dressed up with someplace to go.
I turn and find myself facing Evelyn Dodge, a brassy broad if ever there was one, and one of my favorite people in the world. She's wearing flowing black pants and gold sandals that look like something imported from Morocco. The pants are mostly obscured by a blustery multi-patterned shirt that, as far as I can tell, was created by stitching together dozens of Hermès scarves. She looks a bit like a gypsy with very expensive taste.
I knew today was your first day, she says, but I didn't think I'd get lucky enough to see you.
I realize that I'm still staring at her in complete surprise and blocking the entrance to the elevator. I step to the side so that the small group that has gathered can get on and force myself to speak despite the grin that is plastered across my face.
What on earth are you doing here? I ask.
Evelyn lives in Malibu, not far from Damien's new house, and she's not the type to make the trek to the valley, unless the apocalypse is upon us.
Same thing you are, Texas.
I lift a brow in amusement. You're going into the tech industry? Designing an iPhone app to feature Blaine's work? She taps her nose and points at me.
Not a bad idea, actually. And I just may have to wrangle some advice out of you about that later. But no, I'm here to see Bruce.
Why? The question is out of my mouth before I realize how completely rude it sounds. Evelyn, however, isn't the kind to take offense.
I need one of his keys, she says, then barks out a throaty laugh. But don't worry, it's not for a tryst. Blaine's more than I can handle in that department. And now he's decided he wants to touch up some of the paintings for Saturday's showing, but apparently they're in the gallery's off-site storage facility.
Now I really am confused. Can't Giselle let you in? Giselle is Bruce's wife and the owner of a few Southern California art galleries. Saturday's cocktail party will not only feature the portrait of me, though only a handful of guests will actually know that I am the model on the wall, but also a number of Blaine's other paintings.
If she hadn't hauled her ass to Palm Springs, sure, but she called me from the road. Apparently, she's on her way to get a few pieces from her gallery there, and her assistant doesn't have the spare key to the unit. Why the hell Giselle gave it to Bruce instead of her assistant, I don't know. Sometimes that woman baffles me.
Damien's in Palm Springs, too. He went there this morning.
Too bad Giselle didn't know. She could have dumped the job of bringing the paintings back on him. Would have saved me a trip.
Evelyn shakes her head.
Frankly, I would have much rather gone to Palm Springs than Burbank, and I'm sure she knows it. But I think she and Brucey Boy are having another tiff.
Why are they fighting?
With those two? Who the hell knows?
She brushes the conversation away, as if it is old news, but to me, the topic of Giselle is one of unpleasant but undeniable interest. I'd been jealous of the woman for about 5 minutes when I'd first met Damien at Evelyn's party, because it had seemed to me that she was the girl on Damien's arm. Once I'd learned that she was married, however, the jealousy had been shoved into a dark corner where it belonged. I wouldn't say that the jealousy has returned, but my hope that Bruce and Giselle quickly regain a state of marital bliss is definitely more selfish than altruistic.
And what about you? Evelyn continues. I keep hoping you and that camera of yours will take me up on my offer so that I can ply you with drink and wrangle some gossip. But I guess you don't need me now that you've got Damien's view at your disposal.
It is one hell of a view, I admit. But I'd still love to come over sometime.
Anytime. Bring your camera if you want, she says. Or just come for the liquor and the gossip. Both flow free at my house. Advice, too, if you need it. But from what I'm hearing, you're doing just fine.
Blaine's been telling stories on me. I can't help my grin. The skinny young artist and the large, brassy woman don't seem like a couple at first glance. And while Evelyn will say she only keeps Blaine around to warm her bed, I have a feeling there's a lot more to it than that.
Hell yes! What's the point of sending that boy out in the world if he doesn't bring me back the dirt?
And?
You're boringly dirt-free, she says. From what I hear, you're swimming in bliss.
I laugh. I'll go with that.
Good. Glad I'm not the only one getting hot sex regularly.
My cheeks burn, and I have to press my lips together not to burst out laughing.
But it's more than that, I take it. From what Blaine says, it sounds like you've tamed the savage beast.
I don't reply, but her words please me so much that I'm pretty sure I must be glowing.
So, there's no new dramas on the horizon?
No, I say warily, because this is neither the time nor the place to tell her about Carl's threats. From her tone, though, I can't help but fear that she already knows. Why? Is there something I should know?
She waves an airy hand through the air. Not a thing.
I narrow my eyes at her. Evelyn may have been a good liar back in her agenting days, but she has lost the knack. She eyes me, then snorts with laughter.
Oh, hell, Texas. I meant what I said. There's nothing you need to worry about.
Not now, anyway. Several groups of people have gotten on and off the elevator during our conversation, and now the car once again opens in front of us.
Time to go to work, right?
Evelyn says. You are not getting off that easy, I retort, following her on. I have every intention of interrogating her, but there's no time during the short ride up, and when the doors open, there's no privacy. The receptionist, a girl my age who I remember is named Cindy, immediately stands.
Wow, it's so cool to have you here,
she says to me, then blushes.
I mean, you're going to fit in great. We can do lunch if you want.
Thanks, I say, with a sidelong glance toward Evelyn, who only looks amused. I think I'm having lunch with Bruce today.
Oh, right. Mr. Tolley's ready for you.
Just a sec, and I'll walk you back. She turns to Evelyn before I have the chance to tell her I'm supposed to meet first with the lady from Human Resources. May I help you?
Evelyn Dodge, Evelyn says. I called Bruce about picking up...
Oh, sure thing, Ms. Dodge. She comes around the desk and hands Evelyn an envelope that presumably contains a key. Evelyn slides it into her humongous purse and points a finger at me.
We'll see each other tomorrow, Texas.
Yeah, I say meaningfully. Evelyn is one of the few people who knows the identity of the woman in Blaine's portrait. You'll certainly be seeing plenty of me tomorrow. Evelyn guffaws, and then steps back onto the elevator. I follow Cindy down the plain gray halls to Bruce's office, Evelyn's laughter still ringing in my ears. Chapter 8. We don't even make it to the office before Bruce emerges. When we met during the interview, he'd been the picture of corporate calm. Now he looks undeniably harried.
Nikki, great to see you.
He holds out his hand for me to shake. It's firm and no nonsense, and I think that bodes well for Bruce as a boss. Cindy returns to reception, and Bruce starts down the hallway, easing farther into the bowels of the company. He's moving fast, and I hurry to keep up. If the fight with his wife is weighing on him, I don't see it. He looks like a man with a work problem, not a marital one. "If this is a bad time," I begin. "I mean, I'm pretty sure Human Resources is expecting me."
"I talked with Trish. She'll take care of your paperwork this afternoon. Right now, I've got something I'd like you to handle."
He comes to a stop outside an office, its closed door covered with taped-on cartoons and various band logos.
"I hope you don't mind getting thrown to the wolves."
I eye the door curiously. The truth is that I have no idea what he's talking about, but what I do know is that the proper response to such a question from your new boss is, "Not at all. What's going on?"
"Calendaring screw-up, and I'm double-booked. I need you and Tanner to head downtown to meet with the IT team at Suncoast Bank. They're interested in the 128-bit encryption algorithm we've been beta-testing. You'll be stepping in to head up marketing on the product anyway, but I had hoped to give you a little time in-house to get your feet wet. Sorry to bring all this down on your first day."
"Not a problem," I say. My voice is calm, but inside I'm doing cartwheels. Bruce told me about Innovative's cutting-edge encryption software during my interview, and I know that it is shaping up to be the company's gold standard product. I hadn't expected to actually land such a choice assignment right off the bat, but since I have, I fully intend to use this meeting as a chance to prove to my boss that I can do this job and do it well.
"It shouldn't be too hard a sell," Bruce adds. "The product is exactly what they need, but we're going to want to put our own team on site to make sure their IT group gets trained properly, and that we have eyes on and a fast response to every bug and every glitch."
"Of course."
"That's why I'm sending Tanner in, too," he adds,
tapping lightly on the cartoon-covered door.
"He worked on the development of the project, and frankly, I think it would be good for him to work 6 months in-house with a client."
"Why?" Bruce frowns.
"If you don't mind mixing business with pleasure, we can go into that when I see you tomorrow. Right now, I'll just say that when I was talking about the wolves, I didn't mean the client."
"Sure," I say, realizing with a mental head thwap that of course he's going to be at the party. The first hour will be intimate, just our friends who know that it's me up there on Damien's wall. But then Damien is opening the third floor to a whole slew of Blaine's clients. A voice filters out from behind the still-closed door.
"I said, come in already."
Bruce pushes the door open, and a blonde man with a surfer's tan and the air of a salesman looks up at us. His desk is buried under an array of papers, and probably twice as many sheets are displayed out across the floor. He looks up at us and smiles widely. I know I should wait until I have more to go on, but I instinctively do not like this man.
"Bruce," he says, his voice full of friendly bluster. "Just got off the phone with Phil. He's sending up the information on the Continental Mortgage proposal. I'll make sure he stays on top of it."
"Sounds good," Bruce says, but I have the feeling he's only half listening. "Tanner, this is Nikki."
Tanner's smile grows even wider, and for an odd second, I feel as though I'm looking at a mirror of myself. That's not a real smile any more than my practiced pageant smile, or any more than the social Nikki smile I paste on right now.
"We've all heard a lot about you," Tanner says. "Everyone's been eager to meet the flavor of the month."
He half laughs as his eyes dart to Bruce.
"So, welcome aboard and all that."
I meet Tanner's eyes and deliberately let my smile grow wider. I'll try to live up to expectations. I shift just enough so that I'm looking at both men. Then I pull out all the stops, dazzling them with my "what I really want is world peace" pageant-perfect smile.
"I'm sure you will," Bruce says. "We're thrilled you've joined the team."
The sincerity in his tone is unmistakable, and I can tell by the look on Tanner's face that he realizes it too.
We really should get going, Tanner says,
then grabs a messy sheaf of papers off his desk and shoves them into a leather messenger bag.
Here.
Bruce hands me a notebook with Suncoast embossed on the cover.
You can bone up on the specs during the drive.
He tells us that he needs to go prep for his own meeting, promises me we'll do our first day lunch on Monday, then wishes us luck. Before I know it, I'm standing in front of the elevator with Tanner beside me. And yes, I'm a little nervous. Sure, I can do this job. I understand encryption algorithms, and I'm more than capable of presenting a good company face to a client. It's not my skill that's bothering me. It's the fact that I'm standing next to a man who, for some inexplicable reason, seems to despise me. Bruce may not have noticed, but I'm certain I didn't misread Tanner. Suddenly, I feel a little sick to my stomach, and that queasiness turns into downright nausea when we step onto the elevator and he leans against the far wall, his eyes on me, and his lip curled up as if he's just seen something gross in the road. I look away, intending to ignore it, but I stop, because suddenly I'm thinking of Damien. To say that he's the most successful businessman I know would be an understatement. So what would Damien do when faced with a recalcitrant, disrespectful colleague? Would he turn away and pretend to ignore it? For that matter, if Nikki Fairchild met up with some backbiting bitch under social circumstances, would she ignore it? She would not. I may be well practiced in not showing my true face to most of the world, but even social Nikki wouldn't stand for this kind of shit. Neither would Damien Stark. And neither will business Nikki. I press the emergency stop button, then take a step closer to Tanner. I'm not enjoying the proximity, but I deliberately put myself in his personal space. The sneer fades, and he actually looks a little uncomfortable. Do you have a problem? I ask, ignoring the bell that's now ringing at annoyingly regular intervals. His lips thin, and he pales a bit under the tan. For a second, I think that this is it. I've made my point and won the Alpha Dog title. Then he opens his mouth, and I see his color return.
Yeah, he says. You're my problem.
I force myself to stay where I'm standing. At least now it's out in the open. Me? You mean working together?
Working together? Together? Is that what you call it?
At the moment, no, I admit. I don't think this is working at all.
We're not working together,
he says, making air quotes with his fingers.
You're my fucking boss now.
Yeah, I say. I am. And I suggest you think before you talk to me like that. Seriously, what the hell is this guy's problem?
This was supposed to be my job. I worked this encryption package since day one. I know it inside and out. And I've proven to Bruce over and over again that I can head up a team. Then what happens? Some privileged little bitch decides she wants to work for pin money, and suddenly I'm booted back downstairs.
Pin money? I repeat. What century are you living in?
What's the matter? Get bored with spending your boyfriend's money? Thought you'd come here and shake things up? Do you know how many calls Cindy's had to field? Dozens of calls from reporters who just want to know if you really work here. It's a fucking waste of her time.
The tempo of my pulse kicks up, and I feel beads of sweat rise in my cleavage. How the hell would the press know that I work here? And why won't they back the hell off? Even with Damien Stark in my life, I am just not that interesting. On the upside, Tanner's enigmatic flavor of the month comment makes more sense.
And you know what really chaps my ass?
He asks, then continues without waiting for an answer.
The fact that you're here just because the boss wants to make his wife happy.
Now my head really is spinning. I haven't got a clue what Giselle has to do with this, but at this point I'm done playing games. I reach over and start the elevator up again, then turn back to him once it lurches into motion. This job requires a certain amount of finesse, an ability to communicate with clients and the public, and most of all, a talent for smiling at people that you'd much rather spit on. I flash my brightest social Nikki smile at him. "Tanner," I say, "I don't think this position is for you." We reach the lobby and the doors open. I step out, leaving him to follow. I am the one in charge here, and he can damn well deal with it. I may not have a handle on everything he's just said, but I know enough to know that if I don't take control now, he'll do whatever he can to snatch it from me. As we head through the lobby toward the exit, I see a poised-looking Asian woman sitting at a table outside the cafeteria. She's reading what looks to be a stock report, and in the brief instant when she flips a page, her eyes lift and catch mine. I've never seen her before, but something in her poised, confident manner inspires me. This is my job, and I got it on merit, not because of Damien, and certainly not because of Giselle. I'm in charge here, and I'm damn well going to prove it. I march to the exit and burst through the doors, and half a second later, my bright, shiny bubble of self-assurance pops as 6 paparazzi with flashing cameras and rising voices rush toward us from where they were apparently lying in wait in the parking lot. Before I can even think about reacting, I am verbally bombarded.
"Is it true that Stark is looking to take over Innovative Resources? Nikki, what exactly is your role at IR?
I fight to keep my composure, to keep my business Nikki face plastered on. I hate this, but I'm not going to let them have the satisfaction of knowing it.
"Are you reporting back to Stark's company? What do you say to the allegations of corporate espionage?"
At that, I have to force myself not to clench my hands. Not because I want the pain, but because I want to smash my fist into the face of whichever one of these assholes has dared to suggest that Damien would send me in as a corporate spy.
"Is this a ploy to up your value to reality show producers?"
"Tell us about the real Nikki. Is it true your sister committed suicide?"
I stumble backward, my composure knocked out of me by the force of those words. No. No, no, no. This time, I do clench my fists. I want the pain. I need it to collect myself, to give me strength. I need it because I have to find the will to put the mask back on, to face these people, and then to get the hell out of here. Slowly, I square my shoulders, and though it takes every ounce of strength within me, I look at each one of them in turn. Then I flash my million-watt smile. "No comment," I say, before I turn casually around to find Tanner. He's still in the building doorway, and my eyes locate him just in time to see his smug expression fade. "Hurry up, Tanner," I say, as I push my way past the paparazzi. "We need to get to a meeting."
"Oh, my God! I can't believe you got paired to work with such a twit," Jamie says.
We're sitting at the polished wooden bar in Firefly Studio City, drinking dirty martinis. She eats the final olive out of hers, then points the little plastic sword at me.
"It's like you're living a sitcom."
"No, a movie," she amends. "One of those screwball comedies where the spunky heroine is paired with the completely incompetent idiot, and wackiness ensues." Except he's vengeful, not incompetent. And doesn't the heroine in those movies always end up with the idiot?
"Not necessarily," Jamie says, leaning back and looking smug.
"Not so long as there's another love interest in the B story." She swipes her hand through the air.
"A Day with Tanner. I can practically see the trailer."
I grimace. "Well, you can star in it. Personally, I'd rather have another leading man."
"You do," Jamie says. "And as much as it pains me not to talk about either of our fuckalicious men, I want to hear the rest of this story first. How did the camera vultures know you were there? Did Tanner tell them?" Have you told Damien about the corporate espionage comment? Was he totally livid?
I'm going to tell him when I see him, I say. And yeah, he'll be livid. I bite back a grimace. This wouldn't have been prevented by Edward driving me to work, but I have a feeling that simple fact isn't going to matter when Damien hears what happened and goes ballistic. As for Tanner, I trail off with a shrug. I suspect he's the source, but I can't prove it. Doesn't matter much.
They know now. Yay, I add dryly.
Jamie leans closer to me, her brows pulling together as she studies my face. Are you okay? I mean, really okay? I almost put on my practiced smile and nod and say that everything will be fine. But this is Jamie, and she's been my best friend since about forever. More important, she knew how much my big sister meant to me, how much I'd relied on Ashley to survive all the shit my mother put me through. The nights locked in my room with no way to turn on the light because my mother was convinced I needed my beauty sleep. The interminable hours walking with a book on my head. The second weekend of the month when I was allowed only water with lemon so that I would detox and keep that nasty cellulite at bay. The big things, the little things, and so much more. I was the one to win the ribbons and the tiaras, but it was Ashley I'd envied. Ashley, who'd been allowed to live a normal life, or so I'd thought. Ashley, who'd tended to her little sister even before tending to herself. I hadn't thought about how my mother's harping must have been drilled into my sister's head, too. Or at least, I hadn't thought about it until it was too late, and I was holding Ashley's suicide note in my hand, and looking at her neat, precise handwriting, blaming her husband leaving her on the fact that she must have failed at being a woman and a wife, that somehow she hadn't managed to be the lady our mother had tried to train us to be. Bitch. I close my eyes and realize that my hand is resting on my thigh, right over the scar beneath my skirt. I'd cut before Ashley died, but once she was gone, I'd kicked it up a notch. There are so many memories tied up in those scars, as if each small ridge of tissue represents an emotional mountain. Mostly, though, there's Ashley. No, I finally say in answer to Jamie's question. I'm not okay. But I was. Before they brought up Ashley, I was dealing with it. I didn't like it, but I was coping. And I'll be okay again. I just wasn't prepared today. It will pass, you know. That's the good and the bad about publicity. It goes away. And like Tanner said, I'm the flavor of the month. I smile, and this time it's genuine. Maybe next month they'll leave me alone and focus on the rising starlet who's dating Byron Rand. Brian Rain, she corrects, and don't even try to change the subject. So come on, forget the stupid paparazzi. I want to hear the rest of what happened at the meeting. Right, I say, then finish off my martini. I've been telling Jamie what happened once Tanner and I reached Suncoast, and I was up to the actual meeting with the clients.
I'll field that, Tanner had said when the head of IT asked me a conceptual question. Ms. Fairchild is coming at this from a purely administrative point of view.
The little prick, Jamie says when I get to that part of the story. No argument from me, I say. But I probably should have said nothing. I mean, the whole idea was to get the client to take the product and the team. That would get Tanner out of my hair for 6 months. So what did you do? When he finished, I just casually pointed out that while Tanner's overview was entirely accurate, he left out some key information. Then I spent the next 15 minutes running through ways to tweak the algorithm to give them a huge variety of options. I mean, conceptually, the program is brilliant, but when you get down to the actual coding, then all you really...
Okay, Jamie says, lifting her hand. I get the idea. Techie stuff. You impressed them. Tanner looked like a doofus.
So sweet and so true, I admit. But the beauty is that he didn't look like an ignorant doofus. He knows his stuff. He just left out some important details. which is good because they wouldn't want some bonehead moving in-house for 6 months, Jamie says.
Exactly. I think I'd have to quit if Tanner were working down the hall from me. The guy is toxic.
Well, we wouldn't want you to quit, Jamie says, rolling her eyes.
How on earth would you live?
$1 million just doesn't go as far as it used to.
I toss my napkin at her, but I'm smiling as I do it. The bartender comes over, and Jamie orders another martini. I go with a sparkling water.
You have no sense of adventure, she says.
I think about the rather adventurous things Damien and I have done together, and bite back a very self-satisfied smile.
So, when do you get the money? She asks.
It's already mine, but I need to tell Damien where to transfer it.
Yeah, Jamie says.
I shrug. The truth is, I'm oddly hesitant to invest it. There's so much riding on that money, and after seeing how my mother's horrible investments went spiraling down the drain, I'm nervous about making my own choices. Of course, Mother's failure was about her craptastic running of the family business and her ridiculous over-the-top spending habits. But knowing that I am not my mother and believing that I am not my mother are two entirely different things.
I've been talking with brokers, I say, which is sort of true. I've talked with two receptionists to make appointments to talk with brokers. From the way Jamie eyes me, I'm pretty sure she's cluing in to my deception.
And enough about the money, I say, as the bartender returns with our drinks. I lift my water. To you. Today a commercial, tomorrow an Oscar.
I'll drink to that.
You'll drink to anything.
True, she says, and polishes off half the martini.
Would you have believed it? She asks.
I don't know what she means.
Believe what?
When we were in high school and you were doing all those damned Miss Corner gas station pageants, and I was auditioning for community theater, would you have believed we'd be in Los Angeles, and I'd have a commercial and you'd be on the cusp of starting your own business? Not to mention lassoing the town's most eligible bachelor.
No, I say. I never would have believed it.
So this is for both of us, Jamie says as she holds out her fist, waiting for me to bump it. I do, eagerly. For two Texas girls who moved to L.A. on their own, we're not doing half bad.
Since Jamie walked to the bar, I drive us both back to the condo. It takes longer than I anticipate since my Honda keeps stalling out at the lights.
Face it, Nick, Jamie says. You can't do L.A. in this car.
I'm afraid she's right, but the truth is bittersweet. The car is the first thing I bought on my own. I'm proud of what it represents, and I can't help but feel a little bit superstitious about the fact that she's starting to die right now when I'm starting to take off. I'll take her in for a tune-up soon, I decide. It's probably just something like spark plugs or a gunked-up carburetor.
Do you even know what a carburetor is?
No, I admit, but presumably the mechanic does.
Open your eyes and observe the reality, Nick. She's been a great little car, but she's going to stall out on the highway one day, and you're going to be the lead story on the 11 o'clock news. Billionaire's girlfriend squashed like a bug in 15-car pileup. Don't say I didn't warn you.